16 states, led by California, said this week they're suing President Trump to stop his declaration of a national emergency for funding to build a border wall. Those states include some of Wisconsin's neighbors like Illinois and Minnesota. Now, Democratic Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call are weighing whether Wisconsin will join the challenge, too. Riley Vedderkin is a government and politics reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Riley, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, good to be here.
What did Attorney General Josh Call say yesterday about this lawsuit?
So yesterday, Attorney General Josh Call sent out a statement saying that the emergency declaration, I should say, that the president has declared is potentially unconstitutional. It's troubling in that it'll get stopped in the courts. Yesterday, he stopped short of joining the lawsuit. But after that, the governor made an announcement, and the governor has continued to talk about how he thinks that this emergency declaration may not be appropriate, that an emergency on the southern border, you know, might not even exist, and that it's an irresponsible action.
Let's give a listen to Governor Evers talking about the emergency declaration. He was talking with Marquette University's On the Issues series. Here's a little of what he had to say.
We're exploring that. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think the people of the country also understand that when the president says, I didn't have to do this, and then turns around and does that, that's not exactly a fitting comment for a emergency.
So both the governor and the attorney general critical of the emergency declaration, but not in the lawsuit, at least not yet. Have they left the door open for that, though?
They have left the door open. The most recent update was this morning when the governor told reporters that he is considering and working with other states to see whether it's really worth it for Wisconsin to join the suit. This would take time and resources from the Department of Justice and Attorney General Josh Call. So Wisconsin doesn't want to just join this suit for no reason. I mean, there needs to be some benefit that we could provide the other 16 states in the suit.
And Attorney General Call seemed to put out a criteria for, okay, if this happens, we're in. If funding for the border wall is pulled from a project scheduled for Wisconsin, that seemed to be one bit of wiggle room here.
Yeah, certainly. That's something that a lot of the other states who filed the lawsuit on Monday pointed to as a big reason for undertaking the lawsuit. States such as neighboring Minnesota and Illinois have pointed to National Guard funding that could potentially lose federal funding because those funds would be diverted to the southern border. Beyond National Guards, there are military bases in some states that could lose funding. There are drug enforcement programs that could lose funding. Those are all things that the attorneys general in these states are pointing to, and that's something that that our attorney general is looking into. And it seems that the governor is coordinating with other states to see if this is worth pursuing.
Talking to Riley Vedderkin from the Wisconsin State Journal about the national emergency declaration from President Trump, looking to get funding for the border wall, and reaction here in Wisconsin from the governor, the attorney general, and more. Now, Riley, we saw this lame duck session. It changed what the attorney general and governor can do when it comes to lawsuits. But as I recall, there's more about whether they can pull us out of federal lawsuits. Does it affect whether we can get into federal lawsuits?
Nope. The Republican lame duck session from December does not actually prevent the governor or the attorney general from entering into this lawsuit. The only caveat being, and this has always been state law, is that for the attorney general to join the lawsuit, he would need to have permission from either the governor or from either house of the legislature. What the lame duck session did, or the lame duck law does, I should say, is prevent the attorney general or governor from withdrawing from suits and from being able to settle on suits where Wisconsin state law is being challenged.
You also reported on Wisconsin's congressional delegation. At least some of them have spoken up on this emergency declaration. What kind of things are we hearing?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, you don't often see the Republicans in the Wisconsin delegation pushing back against President Trump's actions. And in this case, nearly all of the Republicans in the delegation have at least said that they're concerned. Jim Sensenbrenner, Mike Gallagher, Brian Steil, Ron Johnson on Saturday joined them in saying that he was certainly taking a look at this, that they all think that it could create a potentially dangerous precedent, as has been widely reported, that, you know, if you get a future Democratic president, President Harris, for instance, who decides to declare a national emergency over climate change and divert funds that way, you know, it really does it undermines the power of Congress to appropriate funds, is the argument that they're making, both on the Republican and the Democratic side.
And we're hearing that Democratic leaders in the House will be moving toward a resolution against this emergency declaration. Did any of Wisconsin's Republican congressional delegation say not just their concern, but that they would vote against the president? Did they commit themselves that far?
I'm not aware of any Republicans saying they'd commit themselves that far. Ron Johnson, in his interview on Saturday, said he would make that decision when the vote came to the floor. It's important to note, I think, that even if they did take this resolution to the floor, it's unlikely to have much of an effect because the president could veto it. This is also going to be tied up, I mean, with this federal lawsuit. It's unclear as to whether the president could immediately have access to these funds if this is all tied up in the federal court system. So there are a lot of question marks there, but certainly a vote in Congress to try to prevent the president to do this, it's questionable as to what effect that might have given his veto power.
Now, getting back to the governor and the attorney general, did either of them give a timeline where they said, okay, we will decide whether or not to get into this thing by X, or is it just kind of an open question at this point?
No, they've left open the door for action on this. The statements from the attorney general were pretty vague. The governor has said, you know, we're looking at it. So they're short on specifics, so we'll have to definitely keep an eye on it.
And what are you keeping an eye on in particular as this story moves ahead?
Well, I think it's important to see whether or not, you know, Wisconsin has any military bases that might lose funding. You know, if the attorney general or any lawmakers are pointing to any specific National Guard programs or any drug enforcement programs. I mean, looking at the way that the state would actually be affected is the most important here, because Wisconsin needs a reason to be able to join this lawsuit. It's my understanding that you can't just enter a lawsuit because you disagree with the president's policies. The president's policies have to actually affect the state of Wisconsin in some way.
Riley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Riley Vedderkind, government and politics reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. He was with us to talk about the multi-state lawsuit against President Trump's emergency declaration and whether or not Wisconsin will join in. Some students at UW-Milwaukee have a unique, affordable housing opportunity. They can choose to live at a senior living facility with room and board provided, as long as they share some of their skills with the elderly residents living there. It's one program of many nationwide that aims to bring people young and old together to share living quarters, reducing problems of loneliness for older adults and making more affordable housing available for younger people. Molly Hassler is currently the coordinator of the Student Artist in Residence program at UW-Milwaukee. She was an artist in residence herself from 2016 to 2018. Molly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, how did you first hear about the Student Artist in Residence program and decide to give it a try?
I first heard about the Student Artist in Residence program from a friend and colleague that was also a Student Artist in Residence, or SARE. I had really no prior experience working with older adults, but I was an art student that wanted to use my skills, so I thought I would sort of out of the blue apply to be a part of the program, and now I'm hooked. So.
And I know the program's changed a little. You didn't live at the center as the current SARE participants do, but can you talk about the kind of art projects, the kind of experiences you had working with the seniors there?
Yeah, so our programming is sort of built around one goal or challenge for the entire year. I identified my goal with a community mentor and also an arts activities mentor at East Castle Place that I wanted to get independent living residents and memory care residents more involved with each other. So an example of the programming I provided was a poetry group, a weekly poetry group, with an independent living resident in memory care. And then, of course, I also did more hands-on arts activities like fabric marbling and weaving and things like that.
And the key to this project sounds to me like you're not there, the artists aren't there to entertain the residents. They are there to help harness the creativity of the residents and make them artists themselves, right?
Right. It's more of a fully immersive and completely like multi-generational cross-cultural learning experience for the students, and it's just more so to bring the artistry out in the residents and use artistic thinking and innovative thinking to really make the experience for the residents enjoyable and sustainable even after the artists and residents leave.
And as the artist yourself, what did you get out of the experience?
Just a lot of community building experience. I left the program with a lot more comprehensive idea of what it means to be a working artist and what it means to be a community artist.
Now let's take it to what the project looks like now. The artists in residence are actually literally in residence, right?
Correct. So we have 5 students currently in the program, and 4 of them live in the community.
And why was that something you added to the project?
That has sort of been in the project all along. I just didn't live in residence. The first artist in residence living in the community started 3 years ago during my second year of the residency program.
And what's the goal of actually having the student artist living at the actual senior center?
Well, it provides innovative and diverse programming for the residents, and they receive opportunities for growth, you know, through self-expression and collaboration that they wouldn't necessarily receive or even come up with as activities directors without sort of this innovative thinking that comes from, you know, having an art student living in the community itself.
I want to bring on a caller. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. What a thinking out of the box idea. I think this is just brilliant. I mean, what a great way for the older generation to sort of adopt a grandchild and for the younger generation to sort of adopt a grandparent and learn about the history of them and vice versa. I just think this is just brilliant.
Well, thank you. If I had a dollar for every time I went into East Castle Place and somebody asked, whose granddaughter are you, I might be able to pay off my tuition.
Cindy, thanks a lot for the call. But, you know, in a lot of ways, we as a society segregate ourselves by age, right? The seniors live with the seniors. The college students live in dorms or apartments with the college students. This is a way to break some of those barriers, right?
Yeah, definitely. And there's also silos even within the retirement communities themselves. So there's even further iterations of isolation from each other based on ability and memory and things like that.
Now let's talk about some of the art projects. You mentioned poetry writing with the seniors. Talk about what they said after you'd worked with them on poetry writing and they were creating their own stuff.
Yeah, we actually started calling the poetry group the See Where It Goes Poets. The poetry group was comprised primarily of folks that had dementia and memory loss. So we based our poems off of objects or seasons, things like this, to emphasize imagination versus memory recalling. And we had a great time. There was laughter all around. Sometimes we would base a poem off of a person in the community, things like that. So the See Where It Goes Poets, even though I'm not there anymore, they're still writing. So
that's great. And can you talk about some of the other art projects that the other participants in the SARE program have worked on with seniors?
Yeah. So we draw from all areas of the art school. So we have theater people, dancers, filmmakers, painters, etc. Right now, one student artist in residence is currently writing a play at Luther Manor with some of the independent living residents. We've had non-traditional painting, so painting with brush and sticks and sponges, things like this. What else have we had? A pass-it-along dance routine from memory care to the health center to independent living, and then at the end of the year, there's a dance routine that is comprised of all of the areas of the retirement community, just for some examples of other projects that are going on.
And Molly, it sounds like this has been a hit. Is there talk about expanding, bringing more art students into more senior centers around the area?
Of course. We're always looking to expand our partnerships. Next year, we've added one more community partner in West Dallas, and we're always recruiting new students to the program and new community organizations. So.
And what have you heard from other people who are like yourself, graduates of the program? What kind of experiences have they talked about coming out with?
They're kind of the same as me. Cannot stop working with community organizations. A lot of us came into art school thinking we were going to come out as studio artists or only studio artists, and now a lot of us have either a studio practice and a community arts engagement practice and are actively working on new projects in the community, whether they be it with older adults or another population. But we're always working in Milwaukee. This is our city. We really love it. So,
Molly, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Molly Hassler is the coordinator of the Student Artist in Residence program at UW-Milwaukee. It places students in senior living facilities to live and work with the residents there. She was an artist in residence herself from 2016 to 2018. Coming up, a presidential hopeful wants the country to provide universal child care, and there are various proposals in Congress on those issues. We'll learn more about these proposals, the impact they could have on families, and hear about the challenges parents have here in Wisconsin finding affordable, quality child care. Now, Democratic presidential hopeful Elizabeth Warren unveiled a plan yesterday that would provide free or low-cost child care to all American families. According to the Massachusetts senator's proposal, the plan would be paid for by a tax on the country's wealthiest citizens. There are also plans from both parties in Congress looking to help with the child care issue. Our next guest is here to talk about how universal child care could impact families and the economy as a whole, and what the child care scene looks like here in Wisconsin. Ruth Schmidt is the executive director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. Ruth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're not going to spend too much time on the specifics of Elizabeth Warren's plan, but what was your reaction to this idea when it was proposed yesterday?
So I think the best possible reaction to this is that there are candidates that are at least raising the issue of child care as a critical support that's needed in our country. I think this is something that both parties have talked about in terms of wanting a bipartisan solution to what's going on with low-income working families, working families with young children, and I think it is just a good sign that we're seeing a presidential candidate early in the process, at least coming forward with suggestions and getting it on the table and raising it as an issue for us.
When you look around Wisconsin, what kind of challenges do you see families facing when it comes to accessing child care?
So I think the primary thing to consider in Wisconsin is twofold. One is affordability of care, and one is accessibility of care. And so we know in Wisconsin that over 54% of our population lives in what's considered to be a child care desert, essentially saying there's not enough child care. So there's not enough care to care for children under the age of five whose parents are in the workforce. So I think that's a critical issue, and there's lots of reasons that we have a shortage of child care in Wisconsin. The flip side of that is looking at the cost of care. And so if you are fortunate enough to find high-quality care, the affordability issue is also significant. And so, for instance, right here in Madison, if you're looking for infant care, you are likely looking at a price tag of $16,000, $17,000 a year. So that's just for one infant. And so we have this tension between families' ability to pay for care, which is really expensive, and it's also very hard to find care because of a shortage in the industry right now in Wisconsin.
And it seems like there's a paradox. We talk about the high cost of child care for families, but then not terribly high-paying jobs in many cases for the people providing that care. Can you talk about that side of the story?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So my association, one of the things we do is research on the workforce. And the most recent workforce study that we did and was released in 2016, we did it with COWS through the University of Wisconsin. So that study showed that for individuals that work in early care and education programs, so child care programs, family child care programs, with an associate's degree, the median income is $10 an hour. And so I think it's not a hard leap to make that at a time when our economy is really strong, there's no shortage of jobs available, to keep people with an education, to keep them employed in childcare, which is often their passion, it's what they love doing, it's what they're very good at, they've studied it, they understand child development, they know what developmentally appropriate care for young children looks like, but we're paying them $10 an hour. And so we hear story after story across the state of childcare programs who lose a teacher to the convenience store down the street. We heard a story about a childcare center that had to close a classroom because their lead teacher took a job at the local bakery, earning probably about $4 an hour more. And so I think the challenge is we have this workforce that's educated, they're doing the best for our children, and the pay structure is so compressed and so low that we end up with a turnover rate in this field that exceeds 35%. And so what that means is that in the average child care program in a classroom, 3 out of 10 teachers are going to leave that program within the course of a year. And so it's a churning. Child care programs need to be hiring people all the time and training people. That's expensive. And so it's a real conundrum in terms of finding ways to retain this workforce so that we can provide the best possible quality of care for Wisconsin's young children.
We're talking to Ruth Schmidt, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, about child care in the United States, proposals for universal child care coming out in the presidential race now. Ruth, can you point toward a model, local, state, national level, whatever, of a program that might point toward a road to success when it comes to child care?
So I think there's certainly elements of what Senator Warren has proposed. I think there's a lot of really good things in the Child Care for Working Families Act, which is has sponsors from Senator Murray and Representative Bobby Scott, and has had a lot of play in our national legislature. And I think there's a lot of really good elements there. And I think optimistically, I would like to see that that we continue to be able to grow bipartisan support for these types of policies. I do think it's worth noting that there are some programs in place here in Wisconsin that help to support this workforce. So in Wisconsin, we have a program called REWARD, which is a wage supplement program, and it pays cash. It pays cash benefits to individuals who have worked in this field for a certain period of time and achieved a certain level of education. So it's a way to retain people working in this field and to say thank you for the years of service We want you to stick around. There's also the Teacher Early Childhood Scholarship Program, which covers about 75% of the cost of credit-based tuition, books, fees for people who are working in the child care field and need to improve their education in order to better support their program that they're working in and the kids and families they're caring for. Recently, we have started a shared services network in a rural community in Wisconsin, in Vernon County. Shared services networks allow child care programs to recognize economies of scale by coming together to look at purchasing, sharing resources, potentially sharing staff as a way to ultimately bring down the costs of what you have to pay for in running a program so that you can direct more of your revenues towards your staff as a way to try and raise wages. So I think there are some good things that are happening. But the bottom line is families are tapped out. Not many young working professionals with children who are in child care can make ends meet needing to pay for expensive child care expenses. And so I think this is, at its crux, it's also a critical issue for our economy. So you have businesses that are leaving jobs vacant for in excess of 3 months because there may not be available child care in their communities so that they can hire people into job vacancies. We know stories of employers who have had high-paying positions that they're recruiting for, and they can't offer the job because these individuals say, point me in the direction of your highest quality care. And in some of our really rural communities, there just isn't any that even exists. So it's a really challenging issue for families, for people who work in this workforce, for employers who are trying to employ people and provide goods and services to the citizens of Wisconsin.
We're talking to Ruth Schmidt right now, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. She's with us to talk about the challenges of finding affordable child care and possible solutions from the federal level on down. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or your family been in the situation of having it be cheaper to cut working hours in order to take care of kids rather than paying the cost of child care? Have you had trouble finding child care, affordable quality child care in your neck of the woods? Do you provide child care? What do things look like for you? And as an employer, have you had trouble filling jobs because of this lack of access to child care? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the idea of universal child care with Ruth Schmidt. She's the executive director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had trouble finding child care that you can afford, or have things worked out pretty well for you? If you work in the child care business as a provider yourself, can you talk about what you see in your industry, the pay, the working conditions, the availability of help for parents? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Ruth, you mentioned Vernon County and projects there to help in that rural community. Is this something where it's going to be hard to find a one-size-fits-all approach that's going to work in Vernon County and Milwaukee and the Fox Cities and all points in between?
So I think that if you look at models of shared services, which is something that many business leaders use, shared service models, it is something that can work in rural communities. It's something that can work in large urban communities. And so I think there are solutions that I don't want to say are one size fits all. But the beauty of Wisconsin is that you have local communities that are already working to address this issue, that are trying to come up with their own solutions. And so I think tweaking models, thinking through in rural Wisconsin, you're not going to have child care programs that maybe are located in a densely populated area. And so you might have to address how to provide shared services to them differently. But I do think that that type of a model holds promise for this industry overall. It's a model that's being done in probably about at least 24 other locations around the nation, and in some cases has been wildly successful at bringing down turnover and at supporting programs in their ability to stay open and continue to provide services to their communities.
Bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Jim, hi.
Hi, I'm just calling to kind of give the opposite side of the coin view on this whole situation. I and my wife did not have children because we thought we would not be able to supply the, you know, the best possible care, education, and everything else for them. But now, since we haven't done that, we're supporting people like these people who want to have more kids and get better jobs and figure out a way to have their children having daycare, and people who are on welfare or, you know, or mothers having children just to make a career change out of making money off of the, you know, AFDC and things like that. I think these people who are making the decision to have children, maybe somebody should stay home and not work and take care of their child.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Ruth in on that. Jim worried that basically he would be subsidizing people who didn't make the same decision that he and his family made, Ruth.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's an interesting point to bring up. Families obviously need to make the decisions that are best for them. But I do know that especially in most of our rural communities, we have a real issue with an aging population in Wisconsin. And actually, we are not sort of keeping up with what we need to replace workers. And so if you look at this as an issue in terms of how do we also best prepare to meet the needs of an aging population in the future, and not even that far down the road, being able to have children enter school ready to learn so that we don't have to invest in remedial education getting kids into high-quality early ed programs has shown over and over again that the return on investment in terms of having a future workforce, in terms of education savings, in terms of lower rates of incarceration, higher rates of home ownership, less dependency on public assistance down the road. I think there's so many benefits that come from an investment. And I also want to clarify that, for instance, right now in Wisconsin, the state puts a very small amount of money into supporting the cost of childcare. The primary dollars that come to Wisconsin to support kids who are cared for through our Wisconsin Shares subsidy program is federal money that comes to Wisconsin through a block grant. And the use of that program has declined significantly in the past 5 or 10 years, probably less than 15% of eligible families are even using this subsidy program. So I understand the caller's concern, but I really want to frame that right now the entire system is purely funded through private pay on the backs of working families. And one could argue that that's really okay. Or one could argue that in order to ensure that we have a prepared workforce for tomorrow and that we have a supported workforce today where people don't have to worry about what kind of care are my kids in, it's really important to increase this investment.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking with Ruth Schmidt from the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association about the availability or lack of availability of child care in Wisconsin and around the country. Ruth, as I understand, Senator Warren's plan for people under a certain income level, their child care would be paid for. The next tier of people, they would have to pay, but it would be capped at 7% of their income level. What do you think of that idea of kind of an upper ceiling for people, maybe up into lower middle class ranges?
Yeah. So in the current block grant, in the child care development block grant regulations, right now the feds really are trying to keep it at families not needing to spend more than 7% of household income on child care. But the bottom line is we are so very far away from that model right now. I know in the Child Care for Working Families Act, which is, again, a bill that's been introduced, it's slightly different. They're looking at families that are at 150% of poverty not needing to spend more than 7% of household income. I think I would absolutely support that we need to have ways to cap the amount of money that young families are expected to pay into a system of care and education. And I think it's important to remember that we do have a very solid system of public education in Wisconsin. We pride ourselves on our system of public education. It's not a significant leap to go from saying it's important for us to support school-age children to saying it's important for us to support healthy development of all of our children.
Briefly, Ruth, in our last minute, passing something at the federal level is sometimes easier said than done. Are there small steps that you think Wisconsin could be taking in the meantime?
I do think there's steps that Wisconsin could be taking. I think that Wisconsin already has a four-year-old kindergarten program that is funded through school funding formula. If that funding formula follows the child and can also be used in community-based child care programs, I think that's an important model to look at. So if, as a state, we move towards more four-year-old kindergarten or longer four-year-old kindergarten days to be able to use that money to support children in community-based settings, which ultimately helps support an entire system of care for children, I think that's something. I think that Wisconsin can certainly consider putting more money towards a wage supplement program out of their block grant so that we have a mechanism for supporting more directly the workforce. I think that's a good thing to consider. I also think that the state should be considering raising the subsidy rate that it does pay for low-income working families that have children supported on the SHARES program.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Ruth Schmidt, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. She joined us for a look at child care, accessibility and affordability, and some policy options at the national level and here in Wisconsin as well.